So we are in Perek Yud. This is actually a very exciting part of the Sefer. The end of Perek Yud of chapter 10 leading into Perek Yud Aleph, chapter 11 of Yeshaya. Some will argue, and I think with reason, that this is the most exciting part of the Sefer. Remember that in chapter 10 so far, we saw we introduced the themes, the idea that the nations are manipulated by God, God's animosity towards arrogance, and the arrogance of Assyria in particular, his willingness, though, to partner with them, using them as his tool in punishing Israel, the northern kingdom. We began the chapter, we read the opening four psukim really tied into chapter 9, so that we saw a while back. But then, sentences 5 to 15 portrayed the arrogance of the Assyrians, and they're quoted with their assertions that they can conquer Judea just like they conquered everything else. And God's response, the big takedown of the Assyrians, is that a weapon can't take credit over the one who wields it. All you are is a weapon. You have no power of your own, and Yeshaya mocks them the same way that he mocked the Syro-Ephraimite alliance, Aram and Yisrael, and said these are the Zanvot Ha'udim, the embers, the tail ends of the brands, but the brand needs to be wielded by somebody else. So too, the Assyrians are all talk. They have no substance. There's no meaning to the Assyrian threat. And what you get now in Perek Yud Pasuk Tet Zayin, chapter 10, sentence 16, the bottom of page 971, for those using the stone Tanakh, is God's statement that the Assyrians will be stopped short of Judea. And that's our opening section. We're going to go through this section fairly quickly in order to get to what follows. But we're going to see here, God says the Assyrians will be stopped short of Judea. We actually started reading this last time. We read sentences 16 to 19, where we said, Yishalach Adon Hashem Tzvakos b'mishmanav razon. God is going to send razon, famine, among those who had been very fat, mishmanav, from the word shamein. We noted that the language gets borrowed for tefillat tal, the prayer for dew. And he described Betachas Kevodo Yekad Yekod Kikod Esh. They will be burning like fire instead of their glory. And I think I mentioned the Gemara comments on that, the idea that Sancheirav is punished, that he suffers the fate of Nadav and Avihu. He's burned from the inside. And then we're told, if I'm jumping to Pasuk Chaf, sentence 20. So we're now on page 973. Vayabayomahu. You know what's going to happen on that day? Tshuva is going to happen. The Jews who survive will return to rely on God. On that day, Lo Yosif Od Shar Yisrael Ufleitas Beis Yaakov Lehi Shein Al Makeyu, the remnant of Israel, those of the house of Yaakov who survive, and we're talking here, just to be clear, we're talking about the southern kingdom. Janine, you had asked the question, where are we talking to the north and where are we talking to the south? We're talking to the south. And what we're saying is, Sancheirav, the Assyrians are going to invade the south. Those who remain, who survive that, they will no longer will they rely on Makehu, the one who strikes them, meaning the Assyrians. Where they had sought help from the Assyrians, they had relied on them, no longer will that be the case. V'nish'an al Hashem Kadosh Yisrael be'emet. Instead, they will rely on God. And here, Pasuk Chafal of sentence 21, you get a call back to one of the names from before, Sha'ar Yashuv. Right? The son of Yeshaya, who he brought in the very beginning, or the first of the children's names, Sha'ar Yashuv Benecha. So, Sha'ar Yashuv, the remnant will return. Sha'ar Yaakov, the remnant of Yaakov. El Kel Gibor, there was another of the names that we had, will return to the mighty God. Kel Gibor was, of course, we didn't know, was it a name for Chizkiyahu, or was it a name for God? The dominant view was it was a name for God. Ki im yiyah amcha Yisrael kechol hayam, sha'ar yashuv bo. Even if we will be like the sand at the sea, meaning even if we will be many, only a little bit is actually going to survive this attack. Kilayon charutz shoteif tzedakah. It will be a complete destruction, And then the term here, shotev tzedakah, they do it in the Dan Mikra. They say for shotev tzedakah, it is the lefi midat hatzedakah, in the manner of tzedakah, meaning not tzedakah, kindness, philanthropy, generosity, but rather tzedek, justice. It's going to be a flood of justice. So the art scroll on this Shemesh Tzedakah says what? Beshesh, not Shemesh, that's a different one. Where is it? Why am I not finding it? English is so hard to read. Right, with justification. There you go. We'll surge forth with justification. Okay. Fine. Or not so fine. But the few Jews who survive will rely on God. And then we are told in Pasuk Chaf Dalet that Hashem is going to remove the yoke of Assyria from those who survive. Lachain, therefore, Ko Amar Hashem Elokim Tzvakot, a name which shows up a few times here. I skipped Pasuk Chaf Gimel, but you see it there as well. Al Tira Ami Yoshev Tzion Me Ashur, my nation who dwells in Tzion, don't be afraid of the Assyrians. Bashevet Yakeka, yes, they're going to hit you with the rod. Umateu Yisa Alecha Bederech Mitzrayim, and he will raise his rod upon you. Bederech Mitzrayim, meaning in the manner of Egypt of old. The way that Egypt did it way back when, and the point is, Egypt was my weapon as well. Right? Egypt was also my tool. So too, that's what they're going to do now. But the fact that they're like Egypt is going to carry through also in terms of what I'm going to do about it. And this is a major, major theme that we have coming in this Sefer, which is that which happened at Yitzias Mitzrayim when we got out of Egypt is paralleled when God finally punishes the Assyrians. So he says, Ki od me'at mizar, only a little longer, in Pasuk Chaf Hei, sentence 25, V'chala zam ve'api al tav lisam, my anger is going to be brought to bear and completed upon their tevel. Tevel, taf bet lamed, meaning their sin or their mixed multitude, as some read it. But Hashem says, I am going to bring punishment upon the Assyrians. Ve'orer alav Hashem tzvakos shot, kimakas midyan bitzur orev. And God is going to bring a blow upon them like the blow upon Midian. What is he talking about? The blow upon Midian. What's that? Uh-oh. Don't shrug. Sorry? Yeah, with Gideon. The war in Shoftim, Gideon's war against Midian. That war against Midian was very important. It wasn't only important because, you know, it was fighting off the Midianites, but it's also very important because that was a war in which Hashem specifically engineered miracles. Most of the period of the Shoftim, we don't get miracles. Or at any rate, we don't get visible miracles. But Gideon gets miracle after miracle from Hashem. Every time Hashem demands something of Gideon, Hashem sends him a miracle. That's the one, remember, he says to Gideon, you're going to lead the Jews against Midian, and Gideon asks for a sign, and he puts the wool on the threshing floor, and the wool absorbs all the water, and then he says, well, I want the miracle to be the opposite, that it doesn't absorb the water. But he has a series of miracles Gideon does, and I think that's important here. Hashem is promising miracles like that, but also they have this fantastic military success, which is rare in the period of the Shoftim. And so that war becomes a reference point later in history. David in Tehillim. In Tehillim, I wrote down which one it is. Tehillim Pei Gimel. David refers to that war with Midian, and the same reference is being made here. It was a big deal reference point. What I'm going to do to them is like what I did to Midian. So number one, it's like what I did to Egypt. And number two, it's like what I did to Midian. V'haya b'yomahu, one more pasuk. V'haya b'yomahu, and it will be on that day, sentence 27. Yasur subalo me'al shichmecha. His load, his burden, right? Sevel, sablanut. His burden will be removed from your shoulder. Ve'ulo me'al tzavarecha. His yoke will be removed from upon your neck. Ve'chubal ol mipnei shamen. That is a hard set of words. Chubal ol, the yoke will be destroyed. We're in chapter 10, sentence 27. Mipnei shamen, because of shemen. So they render it here, the yoke will be broken because of the oil. What in the world are you talking about? The yoke is broken by the oil. This is very strange. They note in the art scroll at the bottom, they tell you that the Ma'ari Kara says that an ox's neck is usually oiled to keep the yoke from tearing its skin. But that doesn't explain to me how the yoke is going to be broken because of the oil. Good. So the other word you could use, right, like we used for mashmanim before, and Yeshaya likes to use words this way, is to say it means the fatness of the animal, but that doesn't explain either. How does that break the yoke? I mean, I don't know, the animal becomes really, really large and the yoke doesn't fit? Like what are we talking about? And that's what bothered the Gemara in Sanhedrin. The Dat Mikra thinks it's because you're going to be really strong. The problem is that that's not what the word shamein refers to. I mean, it's true that going back to Tanakh and even to the Gemara, being large was considered a sign of strength. The word bari, which we today associate with what?
Healthy.
Health, exactly. In the days of the Gemara, refers to one who is large, regardless of whether that size is a function of fat or muscle. It doesn't make a difference. The Rubenesque, right, to use that term, it wasn't always considered to be a bad thing. But the Gemara clearly is bothered that it doesn't seem to fit. It's, the Gemara goes with the oil reed. Take a look at source number one on your sheet, please. Rabbi Yitzchak Nafcha said, Chubal ol shel Sancheirev mipnei shamno shel Chizkiyahu. The yoke of Sancheirev is going to be destroyed before the oil of Chizkiyahu. Shaya dolek v'batei knesios v'batei midrashos, which burned in the synagogues and study halls, and the Gemara goes on to describe Chizkiyahu demanding that everybody become learned and that nobody leaves the study hall until everybody knows the laws of purity and impurity. The Gemara is bothered by this shemen. And we have the idea that the Jews in the period of Chizkiyahu have a renaissance of commitment to Torah, of commitment to Halacha, of commitment to God. And so that's what we're reading here. That's when the yoke will be removed. The yoke will be removed when you have the oil of Chizkiyahu, the oil being used for the study of Torah. So what you get in this section is Assyria, the prediction that Assyria is going to be stopped. And then you have a problem. Because what you're going to have here... How many of you have read through to chapter 11 already? Okay, so good. So there's a basic basic knowledge of what the problem is already. Which is, chapter 10 really focused on the downfall of the Assyrians. The Assyrians are arrogant. I'm going to take them down. Yes, they're going to invade Judea. However, they're going to be stopped short of destroying Judea, right? So this is a positive. I had to characterize this section, even though it describes how we're going to have problems. Nonetheless, we're going to survive, and the yoke of the Assyrians will be broken. You're going to get to chapter 11, and it's going to talk about this wondrous time of Mashiach. But in between here and chapter 11, we're going to get the message that for now, Assyria is coming, and Assyria is a threat. So in between the two high points, you get this great sense of foreboding. There is trouble coming. It's a little bit odd. It makes the read difficult because you don't know whether you're reading a happy part or a sad part. I was happy, then it's sad, then it's happy. We're going to talk a little bit more about what exactly the sad part is, what is it describing, in just a moment. But first, let's read the psukim themselves, because they're remarkably dramatic. I remember the first time that I learned this perek as part of Yeshaya, because when you get to sentence 32, that's the beginning of the Haftorah for the last day of Pesach for Jews who live outside of Israel. Ode Hayom Benov. And I remember as a kid hearing like the adults in shul when you got up to that Haftorah and the chazan, you know, finished making the bracha for the Haftorah and the person's about to start would start, everyone would sing those words along. It was just like words that everybody knew. Ode Hayom Benov. It was just one of those Haftorahs that people knew, but I never knew it in context. So what you get starting there is a description of the Assyrian king waving his hands over Yerushalayim and Hashem saying, I'm going to destroy him. But it didn't give you all the background. You don't realize what does that mean, he's standing there waving his hand over. And it's too bad. The Haftarah should really start earlier. It should start in Pasuk Chav Ches, because when you read it starting in Pasuk Chav Ches, it's much more dramatic. Watch this. Chapter 10, sentence 28. It's describing the arrival of the Assyrians. In the English and the arts world, they tell you it's Sanherib. Don't believe everything you read. We're gonna have to come back to who this might be. Sorry? So already we have a suggestion that it's Sargon, and that's a possibility. There's another possibility that it is no king at all. And there's another possibility that it's Tiglath-Pileser. So we have loads to talk about in terms of this invasion. But let's read the invasion and look at the way that Yeshaya uses language and pacing. Ba alayat avar bimigron lemechmas yafkid kelav. He's coming, he says. He's coming to Ayat. He's passing through Migron. In Michmas yafkid kelav, he is going to leave his weapons. He puts his weapons there for storage. Avru Mabara, they cross Mabara. Mabara, of course, is in and of itself a crossing. They Geva Malona Lanu, they're going to rest in Geva. Charda Harama, the Rama shakes. Givat Shaul Nasa, Givat Shaul flees. Sahali Kolech Bat Galim, cry out with your voice. Bat Galim, these are all places, obviously. Hakshivi Laisha, listen, Laish. Aniya Anatot, and then Aniya, they do here in the English as wretched. Others render Aniya as a place in its own right. And Anatot, of course, is a city of the Kohanim. Nadeda Madmena, Madmena goes into exile. Yoshvea Gevim Heizu, the people of Gevim, they all rally, but they don't know where to go. They just have to run.
Are these places in Yehuda and Israel both?
These are places in Yehuda. We're going to talk about where they are soon. And then you would... Sorry? With an aleph. And then you get... So now you've described how they're using this place to store their kelim. And this place is where they're going to rest. And these places are all in terror, and they're fleeing, and they don't know what to do. And then you get Od Hayom Benov La'amod. And there they are. They have arrived in Nov. Nov, which was the resting place of the Mishkan at one point. Nov, which was a city of Kohanim, is where Assyria is standing. You know, Faith Yado Harbat Zion, and waving a hand over the mountain of Zion, Givat Yerushalayim, the hill of Yerushalayim, where the Beis HaMikdash is. It gives you a whole different flavor to that opening pasuk of the Haftarah. Otherwise, the Haftarah starts with the king of Assyria standing there waving his hand. But no, it's an invasion. Place after place after place falls before the Assyrians, and he's ready to now destroy Yerushalayim. It's a very different picture, at least for me. I don't know if this is resonating for you, but to me, it's a greater sense of foreboding. The problem is, and I come back to Ora's point about it maybe being Sargon instead of Sanherib. The problem is trying to figure out what exactly is being described here. There's a very interesting article, which I'm going to excerpt for you in number 6, but take a look at the heading there. Before we come back to it later, by a woman by the name of Ruth Paz, appears in the journal Megadim, which is a fantastic journal. I love their articles. It's called Hareka Ha-Histori Lemasa Ha-Tzva'i Ha-Ashuri B'Yehuda Ha-Mitoar V'Yeshaya Yud. She needs some pointers on catchy titles. But what it means is the historical background for the military, for the journey of the Assyrian military in Judea as described in the 10th chapter of Yeshaya. Okay. and maybe it was part of a thesis, I don't know. But she goes through four different views about what we're describing here. Certainly the classic view, and the one that you saw referenced during the art scroll, is that this is a prediction of Sanherib's invasion. Remember, we're not yet at that time. This is still the part of the book that in which Yeshaya is speaking to Ahaz. The invasion of Sanherib isn't going to be the time of his son, Chizkiyah. But the Gemara reads it that way, unquestionably. It's described in Tanakh, that invasion is described in Tanakh in Malachim Bet, chapter 18. It's described later in Yeshaya, chapters 36 to 38. It's described in Divrei Hayamim Bet, chapter 32. It's a well-established and well-known invasion. And again, the Gemara thinks that's what's going on here. Evidence? Take a look at source number 2, please. I mentioned to you that this section, starting with Od Hayom Vedov, is read as the Haftorah on day 8 of Pesach. That's a Gemara in Megillah. Yom Tov Ha'achron Shel Pesach, on the last day of Pesach, when they say last day, they mean last days outside of Israel, last day in Israel. So, Korin Vayi B'Shalach. So, your Torah reading is from B'Shalach, because of course the seventh day of Pesach is the day we cross through the Red Sea. So, therefore, we're going to sing the Shira. We sing that song. Yeah, I remembered it.
But you changed your mind.
No, I didn't change my mind. I was going back and forth. But yes, I remember it. The Umaftirin v'Daber David. And for the Haftorah, we do David's song, when Hashem has saved him from his enemies. Ulamachar, and then the next day, the eighth day, Kol HaBachor. That's the reading from Parshas Re'eh, right, which describes the holidays, which describes going to the temple, the Beis HaMikdash, and not showing up empty-handed, which we tie into Yizkor when people make a pledge in memory of loved ones. Umaftirin Od Hayom. And the Haftorah is this section. Why? Gemara doesn't say. Rashi says. Rashi writes, as I wrote here, Od Hayom. Lefi Shema Palaso Shel Sancheirev Belel Pesach Haya. Because the fall of Sancheirev was on the night of Pesach. And we do that, right? The song at the Seder, Amartem, Vayi B'Chatzi HaLayla. The Vayi B'Chatzi HaLayla is, we mentioned various things that happened that night. The fall of Sancheirev, by tradition, is on that night. My point is not to discuss the Sancheirev Pesach association. That's not important for us right now, but simply to show you that they assume it's Sancheirev who's being described here. I should note as well, the Rashash on that Gemara in Megillah says that it's also that this section references what happened when we got up out of Egypt. So there are multiple associations. Fine. The Gemara in Sanhedrin in source number 3 gives us much more detail. And here, for time purposes, I will indeed switch over to the English. Rav Huna said that wicked person, meaning Sancheirev, made 10 journeys on that day. And the Gemara, the part that I skipped, goes through the list of places and tries to explain how you can read that as 10, because there are 14. So it talks about how you can read that as 10 different places. I figured I didn't want to spend a lot of time on that. 10, of course, is a magic number, right? 10 signifies that something is complete in Tanakh. So he says 10 journeys on that day. And then he says, what is the meaning of Od Hayom Benov La'amod? He will yet stand in Nov on that day. Rav Huna said, that day remains from the sin of Nov. What's the sin of Nov?
Shaul.
Right, when Shaul wiped out the city because he believed that they had helped. Well, no, they really had helped. David HaMelech, the would-be king who was a fugitive at that point. So the destruction of that city is what's being punished here. How is it being punished? The Chaldeans, as far as the Gemara is concerned, is often not Babylonians or any other nation there, as much as it is people who try to foretell the future. Like in Daniel, where the king has advisors who are known as Chaldoi, who are known as Chaldeans, who are going to interpret his dreams. So that's what we're talking about here. The Chaldeans said to Sancheirev, if you go now, you will defeat her. You're going to defeat Yerushalayim. Otherwise, you're not going to win. So he made a 10-day journey in a single day. All of this trip is all one day. When he arrived at Yerushalayim, they placed mats until he could ascend and sit above the wall, seeing all of Yerushalayim. They build up this this stack of mats. It's kind of a funny cartoon image, right? The king just sitting on a stack of mats, but go with it. He's elevated so he can see Yerushalayim, and he saw it. It seemed small to him. This is the city of Jerusalem for which I mobilized my entire camp and conquered the entire land. It's smaller and weaker than all the cities I've conquered with my strength. What a Jerusalem. And remember, this is the arrogance that we associate with Assyria that we talked about last time. He ascended, stood, shook his head, waving his hand upon the mountain of the temple in Sion and the Azara in Jerusalem. The Azara, the Beis HaMikdash. That's probably the way Azarot is meant in the Hebrew here. But the waving of the hand is an interpretation of what you see in sentence, which one is it? In sentence 32. Right? You know, Faith Yado Har Bat Zion. He waves his hand. What is the image of a waving of the hand? The waving of the hand is to say, this is nothing. That's his gesture. That's the meaning of his gesture. And therefore, all the people who said, you should invade now and you'll be able to conquer it, what is it to conquer? This isn't a big deal. They said, let him raise his hand against it now. And he said back, you're tired. Tomorrow, each of you shall bring me part of the wall. Tomorrow, not today. And of course, what happens then? Immediately, and it was that night, a malach of God emerged and struck the camp of Assyria, 185,000. They arose in the morning, and all of them were dead corpses. Don't ask me how they arose and they were dead corpses. If we learn malachim, we'll talk about that. Maybe when we get to it in Yeshaya, when we get to the actual invasion, we can talk about it then. But the point isn't that. The point is, you waited. You were arrogant. You lost out. And Rav Papa said, this is what it means when people say, if the verdict waits, the verdict is canceled. You got to do it now. Sorry, there was a... Wait, what are you going to say? Okay. You could. So the Gemara very clearly reads this as Sanherib's invasion being predicted at this stage by Yeshaya. So what's the problem with that? What I gave you in source number 4 is part of the problem, and I credit Ruth Paz because I would not have known this on my own. Take a look, please, at the sentences that I referred you to in source number 4. And here, it would really help if you knew the map of Israel well, but you don't have to in order to get it. Malachim Bet, Kings 2, chapter 18. It is page 927. At the bottom. You see it? In the 14th year of King Chizkiyahu, Sanherib, king of Assyria, attacked all the fortified cities of Judah and captured them. Chizkiyahu, king of Judah, sent word to the king of Assyria to Lachish, saying, I have sinned, withdraw from me, and whatever you impose upon me, I will bear. Where is the king of Assyria? Lachish. Sorry? Where is Lachish on our list of cities in the invasion? It's not, right? Lachish isn't on our list of cities. Where Laish is. Laish is way north. That was a city that Dun conquered. Laish / Leshem. So I don't know where it is, but it's not on my list. Take a look now in Yeshaya himself, chapter 36. Doesn't have to be on the list, mind you. But when we realize where it is, we're going to have a problem. Take a look, please, in source page 1013. Yeshaya's account of the invasion. It happened in the 14th year of King Chizkiyahu that Sanherib, king of Assyria, attacked all the fortified cities of Judah and captured them. The king of Assyria sent Rabshakeh from Lachish to Yerushalayim. Lachish is the staging area. And the problem with Lachish is that Lachish is in the southwest. Those cities that we're talking about on our list in Yeshaya Perek Yud Aleph, they're northeast of Yerushalayim.
Does Lachish mean anything?
So I want to talk about Lachish more when we get to it. When we get to it in like Paraglamet Vav, I'm not ready yet. But there's a lot to talk about with the city of Lachish. I'm just not ready for it yet.
Is that why you don't think it's unfair? Because nothing matches.
Because the whole direction of the journey is wrong. Michmas is in the northeast. Geva is in the northeast. All of these are northeast of Yerushalayim. I made sure of it. I went on Google Maps and found as many of these sites as I could. And they're all northeast of Yerushalayim. This is Ruth Paz's point. It's not mine. And she points out that others have said it before her. It's not her invention either. But it's hard historically to say that that's this invasion. It's true without a doubt. Let me be clear. We're not challenging the Gemara for its read of what Sancheriv is going to do and the arrogance of Sancheriv and so on. However, the cities he's referencing are describing another Assyrian invasion. So some suggest what Ora suggested. By the way, sorry, it also makes a lot more sense for an Assyrian to generally invade from the northeast, because that's actually where Assyrians would have come from. The only reason you're invading from Lachish is if you already have armies stationed there, because you attacked the Plishtim, which in fact happens. But that's one possibility, is that it's Sancheriv's invasion, and that's our problem with it. So some take what Ora had noted, that maybe it's Sargon. Rabbi Lau, okay. That it's the invasion of Sargon II against Ashdod. That's 11 years before Sancheriv's invasion. It's 712 before the Common Era, according to the general historical count. But that's really difficult also for two reasons. Reason number one is that Sargon at that point was attacking Ashdod, because Ashdod had rebelled against him. But Chizkiyahu was not involved with Ashdod's rebellion in the least. There's no reason for him to attack Yerushalayim when he wants to attack Ashdod. Number two, there's no evidence that he attacked Yerushalayim at all when he attacked Ashdod. We don't have any record of Sargon. Remember, the Assyrians loved to keep records. We know where they went. We know what they did. We have the annals of Sancheriv. There's nothing about, not just Sancheriv, but of their kings in general, there's nothing about Sargon attacking Yerushalayim. A third school of thought says, stop trying to map this to particular invasions. That's not what Yeshayah is doing. This is poetry. He's trying to describe for you impending apparent doom at the hands of the Assyrians. Step by step, they're drawing closer, they put their kalim here, they stay there overnight, and drawing closer and closer to Yerushalayim. And that's a third view. But Rut Paz has the following suggestion. She suggests it's Tiglat Pileser III, in the days of King Ahaz. What are we talking about? Take a look, please, at source number 5 on your sheet. You turned the page. Not ready to turn the page yet. Source number 5 on your sheet. Divrei Hayamim Bet. Chronicles 2, chapter 28. Working out the end of the Tanakh here. It is page 1997. This is after Ahaz has already pledged loyalty to Ashur, to the Assyrians. He says, I am going to be living under the Assyrians. Judea will become a protectorate of the Assyrian Empire. And he calls to them and says, help me. We are now on page 1997. Again, it's chapter 28. Sentence 20. Sentence 16 is when Ahaz sends to him for help to deal with his enemies. And what we're told is, Tiglat Pileser, don't worry about Pileser, Tilgat, and Tiglat. We do this all the time with the Assyrian kings. We did it with the Babylonians also. There's Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadrezzar. Don't worry about it. But Tiglat Pileser, king of Assyria, attacked him, Ahaz, and besieged him, but was not able to overcome him. Although Ahaz had taken a portion from the temple of Hashem and from the palaces of the king and the officers, sending it to Assyria, it did not help him. He gave them gifts, and it didn't help. But the Assyrians invaded, but they didn't conquer Yerushalayim. What is the story behind? What's the backstory behind what's going on here with Tiglath-Pileser? Why is he attacking at all? And the answer, Rupaz believes, is that he's not attacking. I brought it for you in the Hebrew in source number 6, and I gave you a brief translation that's on the flip side. What caused Tiglath-Pileser to invade the territory of Yehuda, which was not his opponent, but rather his protectorate, who had sent him a gift? One could suggest that this invasion was tied to the military journey planned by the Assyrian king against Ashkelon. Ashkelon, one of the Philistine cities. After completing his battle in Aram and Samaria, so the Assyrians are up in the northeast, they attacked the Syro-Ephraimite alliance and destroyed them. Now he has to put down the Plishtim, the Philistines. So imagine this, here's your map. You're in the northeast. You want to get down here, right? What are your options for your route? You can't just say, let's take a straight line. Remember, this is a mountainous area. You have to go with the roads that you have. You have two choices. There are no diagonal routes. Choice number one, go south and then west. Choice number two, go west and then south. Right? Those are your choices. But as she's going to detail for us, if you go west and then south, that means you're taking your army largely through the land of Israel, which you just conquered. What do we know about lands that have just been conquered? What do we know about what's available? Nothing. They're desolate. Rather than take his armies through Israel and then go down the coast to Ashkelon, they go south into Judea. That way they can take whatever they want to replenish their armies, and then they'll cut west. That's the idea. And in order to bolster this, she points out something very, very sharp. She's not the first one to point this out, but I like the way that she phrased it, and we'll give her the credit. Go back now to Yeshaya chapter 10, please. We're jumping around a lot, but hopefully this will create a clear picture by the time we're done. Take a look again at that list of places on page 973 without reading the Rupaz piece, please. On this list that starts in sentence 28 and runs up to sentence 32, can you group these cities into two different groups? There's a demarcation in the middle. Not in the middle necessarily, but there's a group A followed by a group B. Can you find that? Rama or Heights? Rama means Heights. Yeah. Why?
Talking, the verb describing what's going on in those. The other ones we just pass through. And that one, they start trembling, they
fled, Right. So that's the division point. Ayat, Migron, Michmas, Geva are places where the Assyrians actually went. After that, it describes our reaction, not the Assyrians actually invading. Rama is trembling. Givat Sha'ul is fleeing. Bat Galim cries out. Anatot is wretched. Madmena moved away, right? It's all about their anticipation of an invasion. And as she reads it, the invasion never came. That's the idea. Take a look now at the rest of her piece that I excerpted here. One could suggest this invasion was tied to the military journey planned by the Assyrian king against Ashkelon after completing his battle in Aram and Samaria, since in their war against Israel, the armies of Assyria had reached south of Mount Shomron. From this point, they turned to go to Ashkelon. It may be assumed that the Assyrian king chose to reach his destination on the shortest route. He turned south to Judea in order to reach by one of the width-spanning routes, meaning east-west, the seaside route which would lead to Ashkelon. An additional factor supporting this decision of the Assyrian king was tied to the fact that Israel was damaged from war. The Assyrian army, which almost certainly needed renewal of supplies as well as a rest, would be able to accomplish this better in a land which had not just been reduced by war. Say he would prefer, if possible, to travel through a land which could supply his needs. I didn't bring you everything that she brings, including the division of the cities. I thought I had brought that in there. But basically her point is that Ahaz is not attacking Yerushalayim, not Ahaz. The Tiglath-Pileser, the Assyrian king, is not attacking. But because he's the overlord to whom Ahaz has pledged loyalty, he doesn't bother telling him what he's doing. He doesn't get permission to bring his armies through Judea. He just mobilizes. And Ahaz is in a panic. He thinks, oh no, this is it. This is the invasion. And so, you get a description of Assyria invading those first few cities, and then you get to the Michmas point. Michmas is northeast of Yerushalayim. It's east of Ramallah. If you go south-southwest from Michmas, you get to Geba, and then eventually to Yerushalayim. But there's a big wadi between Michmas and Geba. And if you look on Google Maps, you can actually see it. It's really clear. So that the journey from Michmas to Geba is really difficult, which is what leads some historians, when they read it, to think there's no way that the Assyrians would have gone that route. You have to go down into a wadi and then up with all of your weapons and everything else. But Paz shows that's actually really consistent, because it said in Michmas he left his weapons. They went to Geba, which is a central city. It has great stores. They left the weapons behind in Michmas. They got what they wanted. Then they went back to Michmas and continued their journey to Ashkelon. You follow? So again, let's summarize and make sure that we're somewhat clear in what we're talking about. Not too clear, because I wouldn't want to spoil anybody, but somewhat clear. Yeshaya describes this great foreboding. The Assyrians are coming, place after place after place. He could be envisioning the future invasion of Sanherib, but it's weird because Sanherib came from the southwest, not from the northeast. He could be envisioning Sargon attacking Ashdod, but there's no evidence that he ever attacked Yerushalayim. Mind you, now we're saying that maybe there is no attack on Yerushalayim, which, you know, you could use to explain that. You could say it's not meant to describe a particular invasion. It's just that there is an invasion coming, and this is a poetic description. Or you can say this was actually the journey that intimidated Ahaz, because they went to invade, the Assyrians went to invade Ashkelon, and he thought they were coming for him. He thought that they were attacking Yerushalayim. Clear? Okay. So, Psukim Lamed Gimel Lamed Dalid, the last two sentences in chapter 10, Hashem says, don't be afraid of the Assyrians. And actually, the way Rut Paz writes it, she says, maybe this is a second test for Ahaz. He failed the first test of not being afraid, so here's another opportunity for him to pass. Hinei ha'adon Hashem Tzvakot. God is misa'eif pura b'ma'aratza. God is going to, sorry, I have too many different pieces here. He is going to cut down the pura. Pura in the Dan Mikra is the ends of the branches on the trees. He is going to hack the end of the branches. They render it here, just chopping off branches with an axe. Fine. Karamei ha-koma giduim. Those who had been very tall will be chopped short. V'ha-gvohim yishpalu. Those who were elevated will be brought low. V'nikaf sivchei hayar ba-barzel. The thickets of the forest will be cut with iron. Not the weapon that is Assyria, but Assyria is going to be cut. V'ha-levanon ba-adir yipol. And the Levanon is going to fall through the Mighty One. So the metaphor here is of God as lumberjack. That's what you're seeing. It's fascinating because there is a classic medrash which uses this line, "Va'alavanon ba'adir yipol," that the Levanon will fall to the Mighty One. Actually, uses this to describe the fall of the Temple of the Beis Hamikdash. Levanon being a term for the Beis Hamikdash because it's built with the cedars of Lebanon. it will fall to the mighty. But it's not what it means in context. In context, it's the exact opposite. So to sum up what we've seen in chapter 10, the arrogant Assyrians are coming. The north is going to collapse along with their alliance with Aram and Edom and the Philistines. The Assyrians are going to seem to threaten Judea. There is an invasion at some point coming, but it's all arranged by God. The Assyrians are God's tool, and God is going to stop the Assyrians short. Clear? Okay? That wraps chapter 10, and it leads us into the start of Perek Yud Aleph, chapter 11.